This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we're bringing back our conversation with the president of the Porter County Commissioners, Jeff Good. He was very, very emphatic about the county's new capital projects that we'd be able to stay on track and not spend money that they set aside for it on other things. We'll continue our conversation on that. Also, a very poignant conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University for you today. And also, Building Brickies, a conversation with Laura Kovach, who is the Early Childhood Coordinator with the School City of Hobart, about a very important pre-K project. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Porter County government buildings are getting some improvements, some serious upgrades in some cases here, as well as some other things happening in Porter County in the months ahead. It's all because of a bond issue-funded program that we're going to find out more about, at least the latest on now, and talking with the president of the Porter County Board of Commissioners, Jeff Good. Jeff, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris.
Now, we've had an opportunity here some time ago from your colleague, Jim Biggs, to talk about this big project. It's a really, really big project, and I think bigger than many people realize, and how extensive it is. So if you will, take a little time and explain what these projects are going to be all about that are going to be funded, and why it's so important for your colleagues in the Porter County government to kind of stay focused, not to look at the money as a big pot they can draw from.
Well, first of all, what we approved in the third quarter of 2017 were two bond initiatives. One was $20 million, and it was for stormwater improvements. Of the $20 million that we went out to bond on, just to back up a little bit, or 3 years ago, the county did not have a stormwater district. And 2 years ago, we formed that. Brought in a funding source for a stormwater fee, and now we actually have money every year that we can use to go out and do extensive improvements in drainage, and it's something that the county was really behind in over the years, and there's also been a lot of federal and state regulations that have increased over the last 10 years for clean water, best practices, all those other things, so we needed to catch up, and so the third quarter of 17, we went out and we approved the $20 million bond, which about 75% of that bond money will go towards the improvements of the Salt Creek Commons, or other words known as South Haven, which is the largest unincorporated area in Porter County that Porter County government oversees. It was a conservancy district for years that was tasked with doing their own stormwater, but I think it became apparent that the funding that they were doing there wasn't keeping up with a lot of the issues that were going on up there. So the county approached the district, the conservancy district, and said, why don't you come into ours? And so we negotiated that, got it done. So now we're in the process of we're out to bid right now with five different engineering companies, start the process of upgrading the stormwater infrastructure in South Haven. And it's very important because the location of South Haven is a very wet area. What a lot of people in Indiana don't quite understand, especially in northwest Indiana, is South Haven, or the unincorporated South Haven area of Porter County, is the largest urban unincorporated area in the state of Indiana.
Wow.
So a lot of housing stock there that is not being protected from drainage and other things. So our goal here with that $20 million is to start the process to rise those, lift those boats up, get that community to drain better, which I think will benefit a lot of people there in the housing stock in that area too. And then the other $30 million bond, we went out and did another $30 million bond. And those improvements will go towards, we have a Porter County Expo Center, which is where the fairgrounds is. We have sort of a banquet meeting conference center out there that really hasn't had a much money put into it over the last 25 years. It's tired. It needs to be relevant again. So I think of the $30 million, there's $4 to $5 million slotted for that. We have the Porter County North Annex building where we hold it's the North Courthouse Annex for Porter County located in Portage. We're going to be going in and doing a total renovation of that building in addition, and we're going to be adding another courtroom to keep up with the court demands that the county is experiencing right now. We're also going to be we're renovating the plaza out front of our administration building. That will be complete in the spring. That was around $1 million. We had four bridges that were failing very badly, and we're moving forward fixing those bridges. That's around $3.5 million. We have the courthouse, which is downtown, where our courthouse is downtown. The courthouse square in Valparaiso. It's a historic building, and the windows are failing in that building, which is causing other problems with inside the building. So we're going to go in and we're going to replace all those windows. We're going to do some tuck pointing and cleaning on the outside of the building. And then the other thing that the historic courthouse does not have downtown is a secured parking area for judges, prosecutors, and other things. So we're going to try to whip out an area there. And then we also, the next part is to, right now we're looking at somewhat of a $10,000 square foot addition to the Porter County admin building, which is downtown. And we're going to be relocating 911 out of the sheriff's garage. So we have a lot of moving parts going on with that $30 million, and we're just in the middle of executing that strategy this year. And so it's all hands on deck to deploy these $50 million, but to do it correctly and to do it strategically. So that's my long-winded explanation there.
Well, it's very important that people understand that, too, because that's a lot of money that's involved, but there are a lot of very important projects that are going to be included in all of that money. So it's certainly worth bringing back to remind people about this, too. And I know that your colleague Jim Biggs has mentioned that you not only want to get the projects done, but you want to get them done right. And so you want to be able to do it and not be distracted by a lot of other things that get in the way. And I know that the reason that I wanted to talk with you and get updates on the program about all this is because I know that over time you've gotten the department heads asking you to put a few words and good words in for me about this various project and all here. You want to be sure that these folks know that the money's available, but you want to also let them know, too, that it's really, really earmarked for these more important projects.
Yeah, and I think the other real important thing that I like to get out to our listeners or our constituents is because of our financial strength and with the foundation that Porter County has and because of the best practices that we've put into place in the commissioner's office, and the auditor has been very, Vicki Urbanic has been very instrumental in that too, is that we were able to get a 2.88% rate on the $30 million bond, and it sold out instantly. And the same way on the $20 million stormwater bond, I think it sold out instantly, and it was around a 3% rate. So it, because of our best practices and because how we were viewed by the bond markets is being prudent and being a good stewards of the money, that reflected in the interest rate and the instant sellout of these bonds. And we're really proud of that because I think based on what we anticipated, we're looking at right around close to a $750,000 to $800,000 savings over the 20 years just in bond payment and interest money. And that's real money. That's money that can go towards roads. That's money that can go towards anything else. So it's all been strategically put to place. It's all been vetted properly and professionally. And I think Wall Street and the bond market saw that, and they jumped on it, which it's a good feeling for us because I think it showed that we had a good plan. We executed on it, and we communicated it to our constituents, and now on the back end, all the good things are happening because of that strategic approach to it.
Now, since you've obligated yourselves for so much money for all these projects and like in the bond issue, how are you hoping to be able to get these bonds paid?
Well, what we did, Chris, is, as you know, we have a foundation that 3 years ago, when I got elected and came to office, we convinced our legislators, Ed Soliday, to go downstate and put a bill together because of our funding, because of the state requirement on spending. We weren't really allowed, a county government really wasn't allowed to invest in any type of debt instruments more than 5 years. So we went down and changed that law just for Porter County, or for any really county that it basically is set up to where if these counties ever come into an endowment or someone gives money or you sell a major asset, that this is a way that you can invest this money. And basically what the law ended up being is very similar to how the state can go out and invest their major moves money. And when they got that windfall from the leasing of the toll road. So now we're able to go out and we've created the foundation, which is a 10-member board, which consists of the three commissioners and the seven council members. And we've invested that money 2 years ago. And I think this year, because of the stock market gains, I think we're going to see right around an 8 to 9% return on our portfolio, which is, it has a maximum of 55% equity and cash and bonds. And 5% of those earnings go back into dividends, go back into the principal every year. So we're also reinvesting into that corpus, which is around $160 million. So we envision this growing over time. So basically what we did with that revenue and keeping enough reserves on hand for a rainy day to make sure that the county has funds sitting there if there's an emergency or anything, we now are taking those payments out of the foundation earnings, which I think right now we're sitting on right around $12-13 million, I believe. And so we're basically, and then in the foundation last year, we created a budget where some of these things can be paid for out of that foundation. So the bond payments will be paid out of the earnings of the foundation, the foundation earnings, and that will pay the bond payments. So in essence, we're getting all this work done, and we're not hitting the general fund, or we're not, and with that, we don't have to raise any taxes, which is, I think, a good thing for everyone. So we're able to keep the cost of government down, and we're able to utilize and leverage this money to improve our assets and improve, you know, and these are buildings, you know, we're in the government. We're going to own these buildings forever. So we have to take better care of them, and that's what this is all about.
I remember talking with Jim about this, and he had mentioned these projects in particular about the work that needs to be done with the historic courthouse downtown, that a lot of the space in the building is currently used for storage of government records and other things, and you want to not only make sure those are properly handled, properly taken care of, but you want to be able to use some other space in there too. And so there are a lot of other things that will go into that as well too, besides the physical work that needs to be done outdoors.
And I think if anybody's been following what we've done over the last 3 years, 2 years ago, we implemented the building facility department that the county did not have. It didn't cost us any more money for what we were paying consultants and service contractors to come in and tweak on our stuff. By getting rid of all that, we brought our own service trucks in. We have three technicians. We have an on-call process for our 17 buildings. So now when we go out to fix these buildings, we actually have the mechanisms and the departments in place to be able to handle those and take care of those buildings going forward. So we basically put the foundation, the nuts and bolts in place, so when we go out and we do this stuff, we'll have a whole building facilities department that will be able to handle that. And when I got there, they were subbing out their snow removal. And we're doing all that now in-house. And we're creating so much more efficiencies, and it's so much more cost-effective by doing it ourselves. And plus, you can control the end product and what you end up getting. You can control that because you're closer to the management of those functions. So it's been a very strategic. I mean, I could talk all day about all the different moves and things that we've made up here, but we're just trying to make it leaner. We're trying to make it more effective. We're trying to make it cost effective. And you know, on the stormwater board, it's funny. Our goal up there is, the whole goal, and everybody is rowing in the same direction, is that our goal is, how can we get the most amount of money to go toward fixing actual drainage work rather than consultants, salaries, and other things. So we have this whole benchmarking up there where we're saying we want that money, I want 95% of that money to go towards the actual fix rather than all the overhead and all the other stuff. And that's how you catch up on deferred things and keep moving and keep it going in the right direction. So,
well, it sounds like too that you've gotten good response and reaction from residents about what's being planned, and particularly it sounds like that I'm sure that the way that you planned all this out is one of the major reasons why the bonds probably sold so quickly.
That's what we think, Chris. And that's what Wall Street told us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it was a mystery or anything. But, you know, being in the business world and running my own company, you know, it's all about creating efficiencies. And that's what we're trying to do. And I know that's not a very common discussion point in government, but I think it can be done. I think you have to move a lot slower, but I think best practices is really what county government needs. If you take a look at how county government is set up to begin with, you know, that would be on my wish list for the legislators to try and start streamlining county government a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think that you know, it takes a lot of it's a very, you know, 27 different departments. Some people are full time, some people are part time. It's really difficult to get 26 different departments all rowing in the same direction, because up here we've been so silo based, and the way that the way that local county government is set up now, it's very silo based. And so it's not a surprise that you have these brush fires and you have these partisan fights over stupid things. It's because these different departments have been allowed to create these silos to where, you know, I'm not giving my budget up. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to listen to you because I don't have to. And that's, I think, in the end of the day, that's what makes county government really difficult when it really shouldn't be. We're basically providing the basic services for county government: roads, drainage, 911, all the basic services, really what county government should be focused on. And as technology changes, that's the next thing you're going to be hearing about with us. We have an IT audit coming back. We have a lot of IT issues, and we all know that IT is advancing rapidly. Most governments have been behind. That's one of the things this year that we were working on last year. It's just a carryover from this year to this year. But that's another area that we want to try to enhance. And by that enhancement, we want to be able to give our users the correct speeds and power to do what they have to do. But the other thing that's going in on the other side is we're looking very closely is how can we enhance our website? How can we advance our GIS system to where when the constituents want to go online and look for information and look for details, they can get it right there at the click of a button. So you're going to be seeing that become much more transparent, and we're going to open up the books to let everybody, you know, because that's what everybody does today. They get on their mouse and they start clicking away.
Yeah.
And we want to be able to give those people on the outside the ability to find the information that they need, because some people can't get out either. And so it's just all part of that transparency, openness, showing people what we're up to and trying to do it in a cost-effective way.
Well, Jeff, we've got a lot of things that we covered today and a great update. Thank you very much for all of this information and a lot of things coming in the future. So we'll look forward to being back in touch with you folks there at the Board of Commissioners to find out how these projects are going along here in the months ahead. And we thank you for spending some time, Jeff, with us to talk about it today.
Well, we always like to share what's going on up here, whether it's good or bad. And, you know, it's all about progress and moving forward. And I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to let people know that. And I appreciate that.
Jeff Good is the president of the Board of Commissioners in Porter County. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Well, my family was all born in Mexico in the town of Querétaro. And when I was born, they decided to come to the United States for a better future, but mostly to work. My mom, growing up, was very loving. I think she took pride in her kids because that's the only thing she had here besides my father. My father, he had to take on two jobs. So he was very busy, and I wouldn't really see him during the day. It was maybe in the morning, if I woke up early enough and I saw him going off to work, and he would come back at like midnight. So he would be gone basically all day. I remember that after high school, I was always a good student, but it was during my senior year in high school that I started seeing everybody else applying to schools and get really excited about what schools they were going to go to. But that wasn't really an option for me, knowing that I wasn't going to receive any federal aid. And I knew that I still wanted to continue studying, but I just didn't have the same options as my friends. So I decided to enroll in the community college. And a lot of people mocked it as the college of last chance. Even when I was going to get my associate's degree, and I was so close to obtaining it, I didn't know whether I would be able to transfer, because even more for me, it was a financial strain on my family, knowing that I wouldn't receive any federal aid. So I started doing research on my own, looking at scholarships, looking at what schools I could apply to, and kind of easing my parents into it. Although my mom, she would always be really supportive of me. She wanted me to continue, but it was a little bit harder for my dad because he was the one making the most money. And it made me feel bad to have to ask him for his support in that way, because he's always worked really hard and I feel like he's given me as much as he can. I started telling him at schools I was looking at, and this was obviously a school I was looking at because it was 2 hours from home, so it was close enough where I knew that my parents could come visit if I wanted them to. And he was very proud of me at that point, and I remember that he started crying. He started crying because he just didn't know if he could afford it. And I remember that when he started becoming more involved, he took a weekend off and we visited schools that I had been accepted to. But he would never say much. He would just kind of look around, and I could start seeing my mom was the one that was getting very, very excited for me. She obviously wanted me to continue, and my dad did too, but in a different way. He wouldn't show it the same way. It was about 3 weeks before the semester would start, the fall semester would start, and the advisor I had spoken to here kept getting in contact with me, asking me whether I was gonna come here or not. They needed to know. I asked my dad and my mom whether I was gonna do it or not, and they just said yes. Although they didn't know exactly how they would work it out. So I made the decision to come here like 2 weeks before the semester started, and I had nothing. I gathered everything. It was a rush. It was just a mess. But I came, and I remember, because obviously I did get some help financially, but it didn't cover everything. And my dad ended up taking, because I couldn't take out student loans, he ended up taking a loan from his 401k. And that's the way he was able to help me. And although I thought my parents would come to visit, they didn't come and visit as much as I wanted to, because also like the gas money or just coming out here sometimes with work, it didn't work out as much. And that was my first year here.
You can find more regional stories at Welcome Project, that's all one word, .valpo.edu. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Pre-kindergarten programs are expanding across the Hoosier State, including here in Northwest Indiana now. And there's one program in particular, a very important early learning program that helps launch a young residents in Hobart into good educational careers, when they're in school at least. The program is called Building Brickies, and this early learning program is under the supervision of members of the staff at the School City of Hobart. Laura Kovats is the early childhood coordinator at the School City of Hobart, and she is with us today to talk about Building Brickies. Laura, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit about this new program and how important it is to get youngsters off to a good start. We're talking even before they even venture into kindergarten.
So important. So our Building Brickies program, which has been around since 2009, focused solely on children who have not entered kindergarten yet. Hobart, School City of Hobart, has a wonderful focus and goal of having all of their four-year-olds in preschool. It's so important for them to be in a quality preschool before they ever go into kindergarten in School City of Hobart. So the whole focus of Building Brickies is a program that works with parents to empower them to be their child's first and best teacher. If parents are involved in their child's education and they have really great neurological information, they can really help their child be so successful when they get into kindergarten. So Building Brickies, we offer many components to families as they begin their journey towards school. One of the things we offer to families are home visits, where we visit them in the home and we show parents all kinds of ways through play that they can help their child reach all of their developmental milestones. We also offer monthly play groups here at the Early Learning Center at George Earl Elementary. We offer developmental screenings, possible referrals out to intervention services if that is necessary for children. If something is identified as being a potential delay, we put them into contact with like First Steps, NYSEC, things like that, so children can get help early on. We also have resource referrals within the community. And the heart of all of this in Building Brickies is school readiness. Mm-hmm. How can we work with parents so that their child enters school not just ready, but more than ready to learn?
Now, I understand that this program is patterned after a much larger national program. Tell us about that and how you all were able to adapt this national program to create Building Brickies.
We use the Parents as Teachers curriculum, which is a wonderful curriculum focused on children ages prenatal through kindergarten entry. And we are approved curriculum users of Parents as Teachers. We follow all of their standards as far as monthly home visits and screenings and all of that. And we use their curriculum to teach parents all about how to help their children achieve all of their developmental milestones, including language, cognitive, social, emotional, fine motor, large motor. And through that curriculum, it really helps parents understand how their child's brain optimally develops, how they can use certain times in their child's development, and using play-based learning to really help them achieve all of their developmental milestones, which will really make them successful when they get into school. Parents as Teachers curriculum is absolutely wonderful, and we love using it.
Now, I imagine that even though you don't get into much of the medical terms or the medical details into this, but I'm sure that in the process, the parents get ready to know more about their youngsters' brains by learning a little bit how they basically work.
Another component that we've been using with in collaboration with School City of Hobart and our local preschools, as well as working with our families in the home, is we're using mindfulness curriculum to help parents work with their children so children can learn all about how their own brains are developing so that they can be telling parents that they understand when they're feeling strong emotions, things like that. So mindfulness is really helping parents as well as preschool teachers, everybody involved in the life of a child's development, better understand how a child's brain develops and how we can best support them on their journey in getting ready for school.
I know that you have a lot of help and a lot of assistance from a lot of organizations in Hobart to help make the Building Brickies program so successful so far here. One of them is the St. Mary Medical Center, and I'm sure that there are staff members there that have helped you all in helping create this program so the parents know better. They can recognize certain things, like you say, learning a little bit about their youngsters' brains, the little details of that, but also, too, how they can take this information and turn it into learning exercises and other things like that, I would imagine.
Oh, St. Mary's Medical Center from day one has been such a wonderful support to Building Brickies, but they also provide so much wonderful support just to the School City of Hobart overall. Everything that they do to help all different aspects, including our early childhood program, they're such a wonderful referral for us. It's such a great relationship that we have built with them, and it's one that we value very much with St. Mary's. And they're, along with other organizations like Hobart Community Foundation, Hobart Educational Foundation, they're getting ready to have their big fundraiser. We're so excited to support them. So many local businesses that really get behind us because our funding does not come through the School City of Hobart. As we all know, education budgets are so tight. There's just nothing in the general fund that could support a program like this. Mm-hmm. So then we rely completely on grants like the one that we just received from the Legacy Foundation through local donors, private citizens, businesses, and we also do our fundraising. In the spring, we always have Spring Fest, and the proceeds benefit our program. And through that collaboration of different funding that we receive, we're able to then provide all of these services to our families completely free of cost.
Now, as we know that the Indiana Department of Education and other related agencies down in Indianapolis are looking forward to the efforts to expand pre-kindergarten. We know they're working on trying to expand to three-year-olds and four-year-olds. Even with the pre-first grade and pre-kindergarten plans that they have they had any staffers look into the Building Brickies program to see how it works and see what they in turn can recommend when it's time to make some adjustments in the pre-K program statewide?
Well, we have met with people locally who are involved in that through our Ready, Set, Go program. We meet with preschool providers themselves who work very closely with members from the state. And early on when that was all getting started and they were looking for local sponsors to get involved with that as well, we were involved in that. We are so supportive of making sure that every child can be in preschool by age four, and it's something that we support completely.
Now, Laura, I have to ask you, what kind of reaction do you get from the parents that participate in Building Brickies and some of the other people that are involved in this, too? What have they told you that have all of these exercises, the things that they have learned as parents and have been able to use in the program, what they've done for their youngsters?
The impact, we're not just focusing on the child. We're focusing on working with the parent. And when you work with the parent, that impacts generations. Parents tell us that they never knew these things before, and they're so grateful for the information that helps them to better understand their child's development, how their child's brain is developing, and they go and talk about it with their friends and their family, and the impact is so widespread. And these parents come to us, I mean, we just had our early childhood fair, and we had a parent come in, and we had the Lions Club there, another one of our great partners that we love to work with, and they're providing free vision screenings for parents. The parent came in, had no idea that there could be any potential problem with their child's vision. This child needs extremely strong glasses because of this, and it's going to affect so much of what the child is going through. Mm-hmm. Had they not just come to our early childhood fair, this child could be going into school with all kinds of vision problems that would just go undetected for so long. So these parents come to us and tell us that this is literally changing their lives, and we are just so glad to be able to partner with them as they journey to get their child ready for school.
Well, it's wonderful to hear, because you always wonder if the, not only by the time the parents go through the program and their youngsters make it on to pre-kindergarten and even further along, if they've learned anything or if anything's resulted, like you say, that will help them make it through school that they wouldn't have had otherwise. Without this pre-screening and all the other events that you mentioned to find out about here, in particular with their health and in this case with the young person's vision. If anybody is interested in getting youngsters involved or grandkids involved in the Building Brickies program, who can they contact and what should they do?
If you live within School City of Hobart, and even if you don't and you want to find out about what is available to you in your community, call us. We will put you in connection with people that can help you, even if you don't live in School City of Hobart. Our phone number is 219-942-7263, and my extension is 8662. We get calls from people outside of our community all the time, and we love to put them into connection with their local resources as well.
We've been talking with Laura Kovacs, who is the Early Childhood Coordinator for the School City of Hobart, about the Building Brickies Early Learning Program. It's a program that gets young people, three-year-olds and four-year-olds, involved in working with their parents as their little educators, in a way, to get a head start in what they should know before they even get to kindergarten. Laura, thank you for spending time to talk with us about this. Good luck, and let's hope that the years ahead are just as successful as the last seven have been for Building Brickies.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Another Northwest Indiana partnership has picked up some funding for restoration work on a very important part of Northwest Indiana's flora and fauna. And we'll find out more about it by talking with Natalie Johnson, who's the Executive Director of Save the Dunes here in Northwest Indiana. Natalie, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
We know that Save the Dunes, along with the Shirley Hines Land Trust and the Dunes Learning Center, are going to help share a grant that came from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund recently for doing some extensive work in an area that many of us know about. Maybe people have traveled on or been around, but they don't really know very much about the Little Calumet River. I guess we see more of it in particular here in Lake County, where it's more urbanized these days, but there's a lot of great wildlife to check out on the river itself. Tell us, if you will, a little bit about how important the Little Calumet River is to the overall scheme of things, so to speak.
Oh, well, the Little Calumet River is a hidden gem, Chris. It runs through the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, is really a premier spot for paddling, birding, fishing, you name it. It is almost a wilderness. And so part of the restoration efforts that we are doing in partnership with Shirley Hines Land Trust, the Dunes Learning Center, the National Park Service, and the Northwest Indiana Paddling Association is trying to restore that land and then also create some more access points to get to that and really enjoy the gem that it is.
What do people see typically when they're going to the Little Cow? Of course, is in the urbanized area, is just the river itself. You get to see little stretches of it, very naked stretches, to be speak, especially if you go through areas where it crosses highways in Hammond and in Highland and all. But you don't really see all of the real landscape of the Little Calumet River until you get almost to the county line, don't you?
And so it's the East Branch that really is pretty. It's hidden by trees, it's a lot more wild, I would say, that East Branch. So, yes, people think of that West Branch as more urbanized, but the hidden treasure lies in the East. Chesterton, right around in that area.
What has it been that folks have been able to enjoy the most about that branch of the Little Calumet River, especially since we've had the restoration work underway?
Well, with this grant, we're continuing our restoration work, but just recently, this past year, we were able to open 8 river miles through the park, through the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and also outside of it, so leading through it. So people are now able to paddle into our national park and alongside some of the Shirley Hines Land Trust properties. So that work is continuing, and now we continue with this new grant from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund to continue restoration, put in some more access. So people are really going to be able to look forward to getting out there and see that wild land, that wild water that I talk about.
Mm-hmm. What type of opportunities do folks that get out there, to, not only just to walk around, take a look at everything that's out there, but actually to experience the activities on the river itself? What do they get to do? Is it mostly just paddle boating or kayaking or that sort of thing?
It's kayaking. If you're into paddleboarding, there are areas to do that. I will say it's a nice challenge for any paddler, and that's because there are still a lot of log jams that are in the river. In fact, with some of the work that Save the Dunes has been doing in partnership with the Paddling Association and other partners, we have been very selective in removing only partial woody debris so that there's still plenty of habitat for fish and all the other special critters that live there. So with those log jams then becomes a unique opportunity for people who are navigating in a kayak or a canoe or even a paddleboard to navigate around those log jams. Nice challenge, lots of fun.
Has it turned out that you're trying to do a balance between what recreational activities happen there on the Little Calumet River, there on the East Branch, and being able to keep it as pristine as you possibly can?
Absolutely, and this is what this partnership has been striving for. Every partner wants to see this area protected and the streams thrive, and so everything has been done with creating access without harming the resource.
Now we know, of course, now we're into the winter months, but when the weather breaks again here in the spring, is that when we're going to likely see more real restoration work continue out there on the East Branch of the Little Calumet River?
Absolutely. As soon as you see things warm up, partners will be out on the ground getting work done, and this work will continue all the way on through 2020.
Now, you talked about some of the partners here. Go into a little more detail here. Besides the Save the Dunes efforts into this, what are some of the other partners that are being able to take advantage of this Chi-Cal Rivers Fund grant this year?
So I had mentioned Shirley Hines Land Trust, which owns a lot of fabulous properties along the East Branch Little Calumet River. They have been doing a wonderful effort in acquiring a lot of the properties outside of the National Park Service boundaries and restoring those using Chi-Cal Rivers funds. So those are some pretty incredible areas that actually right now we are working alongside with Shirley Hines Land Trust to get access, better parking, trails, kayak and canoe launches, so people can access through there. And when we start talking about kayak and canoe launches, of course, we're also talking about the Northwest Indiana Paddling Association, who has been an incredible partner, and they have been working to give their expertise on the access side of things and also remove some of those log jams I mentioned in a way that doesn't hurt the resource. Mm-hmm. Of course, you have the National Park Service that's guiding all of this with their experts, and we are absolutely thrilled this year with this new grant funding that was just recently awarded to be working with the Dunes Learning Center and NIPSCO. In partnership with those two groups, there are going to be stewardship efforts on NIPSCO's right-of-way, which is basically right-of-ways are an invitation for invasive species. And so working together, they're going to combat that, make sure the area stays pristine, and they're also going to use a lot of those Dunes Learning Center students to get out there, get their hands dirty, and do the stewardship themselves, a really meaningful activity.
That's great.
So lots of moving parts, lots of partners. It's the only way that we can do it in the spirit of collaboration.
Well, Natalie Johnson, thank you for the information. We appreciate that, and congratulations for you and all the other partners on this, getting the opportunity to use some more funds for, once again, from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund, another grant from the organization based out of Chicago for all the work that they do here in Northwest Indiana, as well as over in the Chicagoland area, too, and get put some money together and use that for the project there on the East Fork of the Little Calumet River again.
Thank you, Chris. Looking forward to seeing people out on the water.
We're talking with Natalie Johnson. She's the executive director of Save the Dunes. And Save the Dunes, along with the Shirley Hines Land Trust, Dunes Learning Center, and a number of other partners, are going to be able to take advantage of a Chi-Cal Rivers Fund grant for more than $275,000 to be able to get some more restoration work done along the East Fork of the Little Calumet River here in Northwest Indiana. Kyle Meredith talks with Gary Clark Jr. about his head-turning covers of fan favorites from the Beatles and Neil Young, closing out the third season of Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
Gary Clark Jr.'s last couple of years have been seemingly nonstop. He released his sophomore LP, The Story of Sonny Boy Slim, in 2015, helped score Deepwater Horizon in 2016, released a live album in 2017, and most recently covered a classic from the Beatles for the new Justice League movie and Neil Young's Ohio with John Batiste and Leon Bridges. It's those two covers that sparked our conversation. Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Ten soldiers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in Ohio.
How did that, especially the three of you guys, get put together for that one?
Well, the idea of working with Leon and John was something that we'd all talked about. Leon reached out, said, come to Fort Worth. I got John coming. We're going to do this thing. This Ohio cover for this film. I was like, all right, well, the three of us from Fort Worth, I'm sold already. You know, part of Ken Burns' film, double sold. So we showed up and did it, man. We had no idea really what we were going to do or how we were going to approach it. John just started playing that piano, man, and we just fell into it.
How can you run when you know?
The other cover that you just put out is of the Beatles' Come Together. Mm-hmm. As for the Justice League movie. And I know that, you know, on one side, Come Together because it makes sense because all the comic book characters are together. But the timing couldn't have been more appropriate in that sense, especially when you're talking to, you know, with a song like Ohio as well. Mm-hmm. You know, for that to be the two-sided coin.
I think that it couldn't be a better time to have these songs kind of, you know, show up in my life.
Here come old backdrop, here come.
When I see these people out here at these festivals or at these shows and the response, we haven't been playing it for that long, yeah. But to see people sing along to it and people of all walks of life, it really means something. Mm-hmm. About how powerful music is and how art and storytelling can bring people together. You know, you let that guard down and it's like you hear these songs or you see that film and you can relate, you know what I mean? And it's like you got to get past this. The crap, you know what I mean?
All the rules that you use and abuse it. No illusion can take this confusion. Give it up now. Don't let me down.
Your last record, I mean, that came out. Turbulent times indeed were still happening, but you know, it was during the Obama administration and we still had that going for us.
Right.
But you know, that's you, whatever's coming next, has all of this affected your writing?
Yeah, definitely. All this stuff has affected my writing. It's affected my mind. I'm more angry.
Sure.
I'm pissed off. So, you know, you might hear me singing love songs, you know, my first albums and this and that, but what the stuff that I'm writing is just,
it ain't that.
It's not pretty at all, you know?
I mean, I was hoping for that, personally, you know, because for a lot of artists, I'm going to say this in the worst way.
Okay.
But something like this is almost, I was going to say it's a gift, but it's an opportunity. You know, is there a sense that you're hoping that this changes someone's mind, or is this just to reflect what you're going through?
It's a little of all that, to reflect what I'm going through, to maybe spark some sort of an idea, which I think can lead to a civilized conversation.
Every day, nothing seems to change. Everywhere I go, I keep seeing the same old thing.
I found it interesting, you know, you came out the first record, you know, it was really important that you said, I am more than just a blues player.
Yeah.
But I also felt that on that second record, you almost doubled down and said, but I'm an awesome blues player.
I'm completely unfiltered. I'm more free artistically than I've ever felt in my life, and I don't care what anybody says anymore. You know, so, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm at home, I'm making beats. We were in Nashville with the guys, and we rented a studio for a day. On a day off, and we hit everything from country. I was obviously inspired. You know, I walk in the, you know, up and down the street and see
every honky tonk within 5 feet
of
each other.
Exactly. Right, so we're, you know, I'm going off on that tangent. I'm doing soul, funk, R&B, heavy rock songs. Yeah. I'm just going.
Don't you know that I love?
I'll bring up one of the old cliche questions because I know fatherhood sometimes affects writing, and
I'd
be more curious if that's affects like finding the time to write. Has it changed you, like being able to, at any point of inspiration, pick up that guitar or the pen?
it's been interesting to find time. I don't sleep when I'm home, so the house is quiet. You know. When everybody goes to sleep, so I kind of hang out for a minute and everyone kind of checks out, and that's when I'm going.
That's it.
So I'm up till 4, 5, 6, and then he's up at 7, 8, and luckily my wife will let me sleep in for a couple more hours. But
something you can't see, it requires devotion.
You know, but I'll be sitting around and I'll be writing something, and he'll just bust in and he'd be like, nah, I don't like that. And, you know, and I think I'm onto something fantastic. And he's like, nah. But it's funny because he makes me kind of check myself. Children are very honest about what moves them and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pay attention to it, you know. So it's affecting me in that way. He's about to be 3.
Yeah, so this next record is going to be approved at least by a 3-year-old.
You know, DJ Khaled's son like produced his record. You know DJ Khaled?
Yeah, I know him, but I didn't know that.
Yeah, like so he credited his like
8-month-old
with like producing his album.
Yeah.
Which is showing love, you know. So I, you know, Young Z might get a credit. You know, produced by.
You are my lady. I am your man. Yeah.
That's Gary Clark Jr. hard at work on his next LP. For more of my interviews, head over to Facebook or Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Brad Yost for co-producing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
And Speed of Sound will be back soon with the 4th season. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.